for the last four decades. Studs Terkel delighted audiences in Chicago with his daily program of interviews and discussion. Indeed, through the body of his work, Studs Terkel has become known as the greatest of living oral historians. Among the conversations he's conducted are those who are celebrated, what we now call celebrities. Those interviews about entertainment, theater, and movies are all compiled in his new book entitled The Spectator. And that's the book we're going to talk to Studs Terkel about right now on Radio Nation. Studs Terkel, thanks for joining us.
Great to be at a Pacifica station.
Well, great.
My audience.
Studs, a lot of our listeners think of your work, especially those living out here in Southern California who weren't able to hear your legendary radio show, and they think of your very serious oral histories on race, on class, on the generational divide, on the war, the Great War, but they don't know that other side of Studs Terkel that, as you say in your book, this show business, theater, is really in your bones.
I've always been bitten by theater and by movies, especially art films, different films, because I was raised, well, in two places in Chicago, a rooming house and then a hotel. My father ran it, then he became ill, my mother ran it, a hotel for men. They were rough-hewn guys. They were skilled craftsmen, great money, but railroad firemen, tool and die makers.
Sure.
And then came the Depression. But the hotel was near the Loop, the theatrical area. And as a result, some of the press agents, advancemen, would come in before a play, and they'd put posters up in hotels where they thought tourists would come see the plays. Well, none of our guests saw plays. They loved burlesque, perhaps, but that was all. But they put a poster up, and I got two ducats. So at the age of 14, 15, I became a playgoer.
Uh-huh.
And then by accident, I became an actor. Didn't mean to. My dream was to be a Depression child after law school, which I disliked very much. It wasn't the fault. UC Law School, Chicago.
Right.
It wasn't the fault of the teachers. I dreamed of Clarence Darrow and woke up to Julius Hoffman, and contracts.
Quite a difference.
Contracts and real property and corporations.
Right.
I was going nuts.
Right.
And my dream was to have a 9-to-5 job,
mm-hmm,
and to see, read the Nation.
Right.
In those days, the New Republic, which was kind of a fair, instead
of great
the,
magazine back then,
instead of the ragged as today.
Right.
And see baseball games and see movies and plays.
And that's what you mean by Depression child. You mean to secure that security?
That,
right?
9-to-5.
Right.
And I did have a civil service job in New York, in Washington, for a short time, that drove me crazy.
Right.
And came back to Chicago, and by accident met a guy who was a director of a labor theater. It was the Depression. The Wagner Act was in, was in effect, and the play was Waiting for Lefty by Clifford Odets,
mm-hmm,
and I was just a playgoer, dilettante, he called me, and this director, and he says, come in one day, and I watched, and a guy didn't show up, and I read it for the fun. He says, you got the role.
Were you in a production of Waiting for Lefty?
In the very first one in Chicago, yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, I was Joe, the cab driver,
you know,
Joe Ennis.
I'm so glad you told me this story, because I've got to tell you about a rumor that I heard just today. Telling somebody that I was going to do this interview with you. I heard a rumor, and now I guess it's true, that you were actually in this play that has now been dramatized by Tim Robbins.
Cradle Will Rock.
The Cradle Will Rock. Were you in that?
In the Chicago production. Not in the New York production.
Right.
I'll tell you about that in a moment.
Yeah.
I interviewed during my radio shows, I'll tell you about that. But I was in the Chicago production at Editor Daily. This is, Cradle of Rock is about Mark Blitzstein's folk opera, influenced very much by Brecht and by Weill.
Like the Three Penny Opera.
Three Penny Opera.
Yeah.
And this is called, it's Steel Town, owned by Mr. Mister, who owns everything. And I was editor of the paper that was owned by him, and he would sing a song in it. But during my 45 years, as a broadcaster on this Fine Arts radio station in Chicago, interviewed all sorts of people. And among them, four members of the original cast were three. One was John Houseman, the producer. Larry Foreman, played by Howard DeSilva, interviewed him.
Right.
Chubb Sherman, Hiram Sherman, who was the favorite actor of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater, he played Reverend Salvation, and Will Gear played Mr. Mister.
Sure.
And all three describe this remarkable moment that's in the movie.
Right.
In which the theater is banned because the Dyce Committee, as well as the union, and they had to find another theater.
Right.
But they couldn't go on the stage. Only the composer himself was on the stage.
That's right.
Blitzstein. And he said, enter the hooker, or the whore. And where are the actors? They're in the audience somewhere. And the lights pick them out. The most dramatic moment in the history of American theater. All four. As that's in this movie.
Right. So you were in the Chicago production.
That's right.
And that, I'm going to assume that was after the big brouhaha in New York.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
Because that was actually the premiere.
In fact, Mark Blitzstein came to Chicago one Saturday night to see it. And he said, diplomatically, he liked it.
So when you were in Waiting for Lefty,
yeah.
And then you were in, you performed also in Cradle Will Rock.
That's
right. How old were you then?
Well, 20. I went to law school, remember that? So anything to escape law. I did that, and then became an actor, a gangster in radio soap operas. At the time, I became an actor, an amateur actor, no pay at
right.
the time. Soap operas were big in Chicago, radio soap operas.
And you
the
were
director
doing
said,
too?
Try out for gangster roles, because I have a gangster voice. And so
that's
I did.
What we think
so
it
I was
does.
In Ma Perkins. I was in Mary Marlin, who suffered more than St. Teresa ever did, Mondays through Fridays, courtesy of Oxydol.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Helen Trent, the subtitle, Can a Woman Find Love After 35, which is how long ago it was. I was in Guiding Light, which is about a minister. Woman in White was about a nurse. They all were the same script. You understand? The same script.
Sure.
And I was always the dumb guy. There were always three gangsters, and I was the dumb one.
So, Studs, you were doing this while you were toiling away at the University of Chicago Law School, right?
No, it's after law school.
Did you think of becoming a professional actor? Would you wanted to have become
Never
a professional actor?
Never dreamed of it. No, I just thought for a while, and then one thing led to another, and then came the Writer's Project.
Right.
I was on the Writer's Project
right.
for a short time, writing radio
During
scripts.
The New Deal.
Yeah, during the New Deal.
Sure.
And this is one of the ironies. The WPA, now the Arts Project.
Works Progress Administration.
That's what Cradle Rock was part of that. We did it in Chicago, though we were not part of the Federal Theater. Though some of our members were, it's hard to describe. In any event, one of the things that disturbs me in all my books is the fact that we're suffering from what I call a national Alzheimer's disease. There is no yesterday.
Right, there's no history.
And so Ronnie Reagan is able to get away with it when he says, big government, too much. But his father was saved by the New Deal, the WPA.
Ronnie Reagan's father.
Yeah, you bet. The town of Dixon, Illinois was saved by the WPA.
His hometown.
So those who condemn big government, well, except one, of course, a big Pentagon budget, of
sure.
course.
But sure.
health, education, those are condemned by the ones whose daddies and granddaddies' asses were saved by big government.
Well, if you haven't
That's the irony of it.
If you haven't figured it out yet, I'm talking to the legendary Studs Terkel, author of so many books, among them Hard Times, An Oral History of the Great Depression, Coming of Age, The Story of Our Century by Those Who Lived It, Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession, American Dreams, Lost and Found, Chicago City on the Make, and of course, the equally legendary book,
no,
Working.
Not Chicago City on the Make.
No.
That is the great book by Nelson Algren.
By Nelson Algren.
That's the great one. Right. Mine was called Chicago, but it's a,
right.
I must say,
right.
a pale imitation of
Right,
Nelson's
you wrote
classic.
The introduction to that.
I wrote the introduction to it.
Right.
It's classic.
Right. Of course, Studs Terkel's newest book is The Spectator. Talk about movies and plays with those who make them. I'm going to ask you about that book in a minute, but let me ask you in general, why did you choose the genre of oral histories?
I don't know. It was accidental. It was really chosen by Andre Schifrin, who's been my publisher.
Legendary editor at Pantheon, right?
He was editor of Pantheon Books. That was part of Random House
right.
until it was taken over by the billionaire Newhouse,
right.
who equates books with detergents or deodorants. You know, that is, you sell it, doesn't matter what it is. And they forced him out because he had good books.
Right.
Didn't lose money, but didn't make the big ones for them. And he formed his own press, and I joined him.
Right.
But he thought of the idea. I was doing these broadcasts, and sometimes I found myself in South Africa during the apartheid days.
Mm-hmm.
And Nadine Gordimer, whom I heard of, knew me through friends, interviewed her. She said, would you like to meet Chief Albert John Luthuli, who was the predecessor of Nelson Mandela,
right.
who was still in Robben Island prison? And I got to see him. He was under area arrest in a suburb of Durban, where Gandhi practiced law. And it was quite a remarkable experience. I put that, there was a station and a magazine, and it appeared in the magazine, these interviews, the one with Brando, because his sister was a fan of mine, his older sister, and she arranged that when he was in town. And so he read these interviews in the book, and then one day he said he had published something by Jan Myrdal, the son of Gunnar Myrdal,
sure,
wrote American Dilemma,
sure,
called Report from a Chinese Village, How a Village Changed in North China After the Revolution, Unbound Feet for Women, etc. He said, how about you doing a book about an American village, Chicago? I said, you crazy, how can you compare? And so I did Division Between America, and that's how it happened. One thing led to another, and so I have the books.
Studs, this book, The Spectator, is its subtitle is about movies and plays, at talking to the people who make them. When you're interviewing, whether it's Buster Keaton or this spans over many decades, these interviews, or Vittorio De Sica or Arthur Miller or Marlon Brando, who's interviewed in this book, do you approach that in any way different than you would approach either, on the one hand, a political person or a politician, or some of the people who are in your book working there?
I approach them the same way. Ask about their work,
right?
Their skill, or what it is they did. So I might ask Fellini, why did you choose in La Dolce Vita, why did you choose a gossip columnist as the protagonist of this film of a city in the 20th century in decay? He's, who else is the Herodotus of our day? Who else is our historian but the gossip columnist? He's very ironic.
Sure.
And of course, it's a perfect choice, you see.
Right.
A value-free guy. A guy who would write a column about Zsa Gabor and Einstein at the same breath.
Or your mother.
Yeah. This is basically the idea. So I approached about, so in a way, it's almost sequel to working.
Right.
Buster Keaton describing the marvelous ways how silent films were made.
You know that for better or for worse, people in show business, and increasingly so, hold such a special place in this society of ours. I mean, they really are, I think probably unfortunately, revered as something very special.
Well, see, now we have more and more entertainment as news.
Right.
You know, the news. Originally, the news was news. Then sports became the big thing.
That was
sports,
back then.
Then sports. Entertainment
right.
is news.
Right.
And so they're celebrated for being celebrated.
Right.
Do you follow?
Sure.
They're at celebrity rather than a celebrated person. In this book, I have celebrated people that right. are celebrated for their work. Celebrated
right.
by me, at least.
Right.
You see, by me.
When you did these interviews with these celebrities, or as
yeah.
you call them, celebrated people,
yeah.
right? You were interested in their accomplishments and not in their fame.
That's right.
Yeah.
In fact, the trouble with Marlon Brando is he didn't want to speak about that at all. He was asking
why I was doing what I was doing.
So it became sort of a duel of sort. But I found it very interesting. I know some people thought he was pretentious. I didn't feel that. I felt he was pretty serious.
Curious.
And I was quite moved by it, as a matter of fact. Others didn't,
but
mostly all the others spoke of their work. Marstel, of course, was brilliant.
Zero Marstel.
Yeah, he was brilliant in that he not
one
only
of the great actors blacklisted, right?
Oh, he was blacklisted,
yeah.
Sure. By the way, I was blacklisted too. My anger, my fury was the fact I looked up Red Channels looking for my name.
Red Channels was the blacklisting.
Yeah, and I saw
right
the names of all
Hollywood.
The people I admired in it. Arthur Miller, Jeremiah Stallone. I couldn't find my name. And I attribute that to New York parochialism. I felt just like a blue-haired dowager who didn't make the social register.
Just cut out, right?
And
he wanted
I
to
was,
be on that blacklist,
I was,
right?
Of course. All those people I admired were in it, you know.
I'm speaking to Studs Terkel, his new book, The Spectator, talk about movies and plays with those who make them. These people who make movies and plays, are they any different than the cab drivers and the steel workers that you speak to in working?
Remember, I treat them the same way. Now, I'm interested because of my own fantasies, movies the role it played. Like, I have a chapter there called Overture, and it's
right.
something called something of a riff
right.
in which I have fantasies, like when I wake up in the morning and the sun is coming through, it's a cool sun, and the leaves are trembling. It's the opening of Rashomon to me.
Right.
See? Remember the scene, the woodcutter's going through, and he sees a man's hat and a woman's robe and a rope. Something terrible has happened. Something terrible has happened. I've overslept. Too much Benadryl. And I get up, and then I stumble over a dumbbell. because I had a quintuple bypass, and so I'm taking the dumbbells for
building
cardiac
efficient
rehab.
Right.
But I was careless. I stumble over the dumbbells.
Ouch.
And I sprain my neck. Mm-hmm. So I'm wearing a neck brace, a cervical collar, look in the mirror, and I'm Eric von Stroheim in Grand Illusion. You know, in the movie Grand Illusion, the great movie where he's the commandant,
sure,
of a prisoner of war, and the prisoners
nuts
are French.
Right.
Our French. No, this is World War One. Our French officers, and he respects this one.
That was Grand Illusion.
Inmate of his, inmate. This guy, Captain Bolger,
right?
He and two fellow aristocrats, but this guy's trying to help his two other guys escape, and I'm Eric von Stroheim, and I've got a gun. I said, I don't want to shoot you, and please step, come down, Captain, but come down, I beg of you. And I hear a voice says, you come down. Breakfast is getting cold. It's my wife. Someone woke me, you see. So that's part of my influence.
Studs, you still have that great love for the movies and theater?
It's
kind of hard, isn't it, nowadays?
I do, except that I got a hearing problem, and some theaters have it, and it doesn't work, and some don't, and so I have a problem in hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I'm talking to you, I've got these hearing aids on, the earphones on.
You're doing fine.
But I still miss some of you. See, the reason I think of the old movies, because a certain moment in my life, you see, we forget that certain moments in your life determines how you feel about a movie. So when I interview Jimmy Cagney in the movie, he says, I accuse him of what he did to Chicago's reputation, you know, in Public Enemy, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's a very diffident, gentle sort of guy, doing his job, you know. And he describes a scene, that's a famous scene, he's a gangster in Public Enemy, 1930, and he puts a grapefruit in Mae Clark's face. He's tired of this girl he's living with. He's in love with Jean Harlow. And it was a sensational scene, a shock. A guy shoves a grapefruit in a woman's face. I didn't mean to do it, he said. I just thought of... See, we're supposed to have scrambled eggs, but it's too messy. So I saw the shoved it in a puss, and that became a big scene. And then he tells about himself and Hell's Angels. But basically, he was a very modest, diffident sort of guy.
Studs Terkel, let me ask you about a couple of the specific people in
sure
the book. And if this goes back over 40 years, if you remember them, fine. If you don't, we'll move on to the next one. But I'm curious about two great actors here, at least in my judgment. One is Simone Signoret, departed, and the very great Ian McKellen. Can you tell us anything about either one of these?
Well, Senior, I interviewed her when she had been married to Yves Montand, who was very popular in France, a singer of songs.
Right.
And she had finished doing Room at the Top, in which she played this middle-aged woman and who was attractive, more attractive than the young girl to this guy, this guy, Lawrence Harvey, who was once a kid, move up. And the letter, she says, what changed, what made you think the way you thought? She became quite a liberal person in a very good sense. She's the war, a simple thing called the war. She was doing The Little Foxes at the time, a French version.
Yeah.
And The Little Foxes brought it back to her. That family could easily have been the Hubbard family. She's Regina, could easily have been pro-Nazis. She describes the three people in the war. Those who said, let's go along with them. Those who say were nationalists, anti-German, and the others who were actual of all sorts who were fighting Nazi idea. And so that was the litmus paper for her. And
right,
she saw all her plays in that form. She was one. Now, Ian McKellen was trying, he was asking about Shakespeare, his Shakespearean roles.
One of the great, perhaps the best of Shakespearean actors.
And he did Coriolanus. Now, what was your image? Coriolanus is this proud guy, this war hero. Well, it couldn't be Eisenhower's a model, because Eisenhower had kind of cut to the wind. He didn't. Someone who was arrogant as far as public's concerned, didn't need the public. And who do you think his model was? I said, De Gaulle? No. John McEnroe. The base, John McEnroe.
The tennis player.
The hell with the public. I'm great. I don't need them. He thought of him.
Wow.
See, you know, he's all wily in that vein.
Yeah.
And for that matter, Jonathan Miller, the director.
Yes.
The wit, you know.
Sure.
Who directed operas, too, used that same technique.
Studs, I see Jimmy Baldwin here. James Baldwin.
He's in only briefly in this. It's a sequence called Out of the Shadows,
right,
involving Lorena Hansberry, who wrote Raisin on the Sun, whom I knew quite well in Chicago, died so young, and August Wilson, and Moms Mabley was in there. But also, Jane Baldwin briefly discussing movie, the movie The Defiant Ones, having for certain reasons.
Sidney Poitier Tony Curtis, two escaped convicts chained together.
Chained together, but it so happens that Tony Curtis falls off this train and looks like Poche can make it. And so he says he saw it in two theaters, one in up in downtown white audience and one uptown black audience in New York. And when Sidney Poitier hopped off that train to save his partner,
Tony Curtis, right?
Tony Curtis, the white audience cheered. Oh, that was a wonderful brotherhood fraternity. The black audience said, get back on that train, you fool. You're not going to get someone. So that is it. But I have him in mind for a third book, I must point out, Andre Shiffrin. I'm 87 now.
Oh,
I
young.
Just finished this. Andre says, well, this is the beginning of a trilogy.
Well, you've got another six or seven books left.
Well, boy, he says, in those 45 years in FMC, you interviewed as well as actors and directors of theater. You've interviewed opera singers, leader singers, Lotta Lehmann, the great leader singer, mm-hmm. why she said goodbye to the audience, her accompanist, John Vickers, the great Helton tenor who loathes Wagner. we have... Earl Hines, early Chicago, as well as Lil Hardin Armstrong and her role in Louis' life and her
right.
own. And we have the folk singer John Jacob Niles and Pete and of course, Mahalia Jackson and Thomas A. Dorsey, the great gospel. That's called The Listener.
Right.
And then he says, you got a third book called The Reader.
Wow.
And that's about the writers and poets and others. And that's got Baldwin in his first interview.
So you've got Nobody your work cut
what.
Out for
so
you.
So that's what he says. And I'll be 102 years old. I said, what do we do after that? He says, I'm going to talk about it further.
You can start the memoirs. Studs, I was surprised to find Arnold Schwarzenegger among those interviewed here because, as you said, you wanted to talk to people who were celebrated rather than celebrities. I think of Schwarzenegger more of a celebrity.
Well, he's in for a certain reason. He was in a previous book. So was Uta Hagen, the actress.
Right.
And that chapter is called Success, near the end of the book. It follows a chapter on Eugene O'Neill, thoughts about him, and failure. And Edward Albee is in it, as well as Jason Robards and Jose Quintero, who helped recreate O'Neill.
Sure.
And so that's what is failure, then success. And this success, so you have a contrast. Schwarzenegger says, I want to be number one in bodybuilding, be number one in money, number one in everything, be number one. Whereas Uta Hagen says, number one means nothing to me, being a household word. Bounty's a household word. Toilet paper's a household word. Charmin's a household word. Lysol's a household word. I'm an actress and a director, and I have this theater reaching people. So both views of success, that's
right.
Why
he's so he's in for a little bit of contrast, right?
That's right.
Studs, where do you think we're at today as a country? I mean, you're pretty free with your opinions. Given looking back over your life and over your career and the privilege of having seen so much pass before your eyes, are we going forward or backward?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. It's both. It's both. The great, you know, there's a great comment made by Jesse de la Cruz, a farm worker. I quote her all the time. Mm-hmm. My Spanish is terrible, but it's esperanza, hope, muera, muerta, dies al último, last. Hope dies last.
Right.
And
last
there's hope
standing.
In the streets of Seattle. During the WTO. Now, that's a hopeful thing.
Yeah.
Something happened bottom up. Said it was too much. And so you got the Teamsters and you got the Turtles.
Right.
It's Nation article. By the way, William Grider is the great new addition to the Nation.
Yes.
Bill Grider of the Rolling
Absolutely.
Stone is wonderful. He's got a big article on that, on the whole matter of the global economy. And I think unless there's a recognition, unless there's regulation, recognition of rights of all over the world, you know, unless there is that, there got to be a disaster. You know, the bubble's going to burst, you know. I think of the Depression, hard times. More and more people say are richer and richer and richer. Then we mentioned the fact that many employed are temporaries, no benefits whatsoever, none.
Sure.
You know, George and Lenny and the Mice and Men?
Of course.
Were temps, right? they worked in the ranch, right?
Right.
A farm worker's temps. You know, the trucks, the labor exchanges. Well, temps now work in banks and insurance companies and all over. And so, hey, we're talking about things better. The gap is bigger than ever. And unless, if this can't go on the way it is, wilder and wilder, unless there is some kind of regulation.
Jeez.
And so the hope, I think what happened in the streets of Seattle is a hopeful sign.
Studs, do you think that we've lost our sense of each other as a nation. I don't mean that in a patriotic sense, but in a kind of collective societal way.
Well, see, if we lose a sense of past and what happened, we have to lose a sense of present as well.
Sure.
And so I'll use this anecdote, which I tell so often, but it's worth telling. It's about this couple. Now, as you can see, I talk a lot. On the bus, I don't drive a car, so I take the bus a lot. They know me on the bus, and I talk. And people respond, except this one couple, this one handsome young couple, and they're yuppies. I hate to use that word, because most young are not that. Most young are worried, but these are... He's very handsome, got a Brooks Brothers, J. Press, and he's got the Wall Street Journal. And she's beautiful, and she's got Neiman Marcus clothes, Bloomingdale, and she's got Vanity Fair.
Right.
And I can't crack them. You know, I'm making conversation, and the bus is late, and I say, Labor Day is coming up, just for the fun of it. Labor Day was coming up. He just turns, looks at me like an old coward, look at that speck of dust. And then I'm hurt in my ego. I talk about my ego is at stake. So I say, I'm just going to get mad. I say, we used to march down State Street Labor Day, singing Solidarity Forever, which side are you on? UAW, CIO, banners flying. He looks says, we despise unions. I say, oh boy, I got a pigeon here. There's no bus. And so I say, how many hours a day do you work? And he's caught off guard. He says, 8. How come you don't work 18 hours a day? Your great-grandparents did, because four guys got hanged for you back in 1886.
In Chicago.
Haymarket Affair, fighting for the 8 hours. Hanged for you to work 8 hours. And this time he's against the mailbox and he's scared. This nut, you know? And she drops the vanity. If I pick it up, Courtney, hand it back to her. And he's scared. And I say, how many hours a week do you work? And he says, 40. I said, how come you don't work 80? You know why? Because men and women got their heads busted fighting for you in the 30s or 40 hours. But listen, they're on the bus, and I never see them again, but they live in this condominium.
Right.
On the 35th floor, so looking down below. To this day, but every morning, she's looking out the window, he says, is that old nut still out there? Well, now, I'm not going to condemn them, because how do they know about labor? No one told them about that.
Sure.
You pick up a newspaper, what are the feature section, sports section, entertainment section, business section? Is there a labor section? Is there a labor page? Is there a labor column? Hardly. And so how do they know about it? And so that's what it's about.
Studs, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. It's really been great.
It's been great. A very good question.
No, my pleasure. Studs Terkel, author of so many great works. Most recently, his book is entitled The Spectator, Talk About Movies and Plays with Those Who Make Them. Studs Terkel, thanks again.
Thank you very much.